American security runs through Moscow, whether we like it or not. So the American political elite needs to grow up and get over whatever qualms they have about whether or not Mr. Putin is a crook or a bad guy, and get on with the hard work of diplomacy and the hard work of working with the Russians in order to defeat ISIS in the Middle East.
That's James W. Carden. We talk with him about what he warns could be the Democrats' Benghazi, the campaign against Russia charging that Putin colluded with Donald Trump to influence the presidential election. Could it be leading us to a nuclear showdown with Russia? That's our topic today on What You Need to Know, a special web-only series for Writer's Voice. James W. Carden, thank you so much for coming out to talk with me here. You are a contributing writer for The Nation and also the editor of the American Committee for East-West Accords, eastwestaccord.com. What is the American Committee for East-West Accord?
Well, the American Committee for East-West Accord is a group of former government officials, academics, and businessmen who have been rather alarmed at the state of U.S.-Russian relations as they have developed over the past 3 or 4 years, particularly since the crisis in Ukraine. It takes its name from the old Committee for East-West Accord, which was very active during the Cold War and was one of the leading pro-détente voices in the 70s and 80s, and included people like PepsiCo CEO Don Kendall and the diplomat and historian George F. Cannon. So the current iteration of the American Committee for East-West Accord is perhaps the leading, perhaps maybe the only pro-détente organization in the country at the moment. And its members include former senator and presidential candidate Bill Bradley and former Secretary of Defense Chuck Hagel, and very well-regarded academics like Stephen F. Cohen and Duke University's Ellen Mikheyevich.
And you yourself were an advisor on Russia to the Special Representative for Global Intergovernmental Affairs at the U.S. State Department. When did you serve?
I served in late 2011 through 2012, into the very beginning of 13. So under Secretary Clinton, and the special representative who I advised was a member of the Secretary's senior staff.
Now, I've called you to talk with us here on a piece that you wrote for The Nation, in which you said that the House Intelligence Committee hearing on Russia, which was just going on this past week, was political theater. Why did you call it political theater?
Because it seemed to me, while watching it, that the point of it was not to uncover the truth, whatever that may be, but for Democrats to hype what so far have been evidence-free accusations of Russian interference in the election, and for Republicans to spend most of the time going after the anonymous leakers in the intelligence community. So they were really talking past each other in the pursuit of scoring political points. And it sort of confirmed my suspicion that Congress is not equipped to carry out any sort of honest, independent, bipartisan investigation into what actually may or may not have happened during the course of the campaign.
Now, the allegations of this, which have been a drumbeat that first started with the Democratic Party, but has been vociferously taken up by the New York Times and other newspapers, is that the Russians hacked into the DNC and interfered with our elections. I wonder if you could just say how they are supposed to have interfered with our elections. So say, what are the allegations, and then what's the evidence for them?
Well, the allegations are pretty straightforward. Vladimir Putin directed some hackers who may or may not be associated with Russian intelligence to hack into John Podesta's emails and to hack into the DNC and release embarrassing information via WikiLeaks about the Clinton campaign, because we are told that Vladimir Putin hates Hillary Clinton so much that he would do anything to embarrass her and tip the scales of the election in favor of Donald J. Trump. The evidence is exceedingly flimsy. The intelligence report that was released in January, I believe, didn't really focus on whether or not it was the Russians who did the hacking and then handed the information over to WikiLeaks. It focused on RT, the Russian state media outlet that is supposed to have some sort of grand ambition to undermine Western democracy. It's all really a bit silly. RT doesn't have much of a viewership. I mean, I've been on it a number of times. If they have any sort of bias, RT America, at least, has very left-wing bias. It's kind of like a left-wing Fox News. So I don't know how that computes, how a left-wing Fox News tips the scale for Donald J. Trump. And then in terms of whether or not the Russians are in league with WikiLeaks, that's simply conjecture. I mean, WikiLeaks, you know, has been very active long before all this Russia panic. There's very little evidence to suggest that WikiLeaks is actually a front for Russian intelligence. In fact, one of the men who was responsible for the NSA's collection programs, a gentleman by the name of Wayne Binney, in his opinion, and he would know, in his opinion, the embarrassing information that made its way to WikiLeaks was not the result of a hack. It was the result of a leak. It was the result of – it came from a disgruntled insider at the DNC. So, you know, we simply don't know. But the idea that the Russians hacked John Podesta's email, then sent the information to WikiLeaks, and then WikiLeaks publishes it, and that influences the elections, simply preposterous. And the reason that Democrats have latched onto this is because they are rightfully embarrassed by the fact that they lost to Donald Trump. The Clinton operation ran a very lousy campaign. You know, it's just simply unimaginable that the reason Hillary Clinton lost Wisconsin, Michigan, Ohio, and Pennsylvania is because of some embarrassing stuff that WikiLeaks published is preposterous, and it's insulting to the voters.
Well, James W. Carden, there have been other indications, however, of close connections between the Trump administration and the Putin administration from a totally different angle, not from the angle of interfering with the elections, but from the angle of business dealings, everything from, well, Paul Manafort, for example, but loans through Deutsche Bank connected supposedly to the Russians.
If we could just talk about Manafort for a second, because Manafort has been the focus of a lot of this, and I'm not a fan of Paul Manafort or political consultants of any stripe. I don't doubt that Paul Manafort has you know, probably a number of shady things in his background. But the accusation against Manafort goes something like this. This is easy for Democrats on television to do because they are secure in the knowledge that Americans really don't know much about what I'm about to tell you. So Manafort, it is said, is a stalking horse for Putin. Okay, why? Because he worked for Viktor Yanukovych, who is ceaselessly said to be the pro-Russian former president of Ukraine. Now, that's fine as far as it goes, but the Party of Regions was nominally pro-Russian because the eastern half of Ukraine is mainly Russian-speaking. They're mainly ethnically Russian, right? So the idea that because Manafort did some political work for the deposed quote unquote pro-Russian president of Ukraine is something of a stretch, because it leaves out a very salient detail. And the detail is this: Putin hates Yanukovych. Now, he rescued him. Yanukovych had to flee from the violent overthrow of his government in February 2014. But the idea that, you know, because Manafort did some political consulting in Ukraine, he's you know, a stalking horse of the Kremlin is really a stretch. But, you know, it, intuitively it sounds okay.
Well, let
so
me
people
ask you,
get away with these accusations, but I mean, you know, I don't doubt that there's some dodgy stuff going on with the ledger and his payments and all that stuff, but that doesn't really mean that, you know, Manafort was working hand in hand with the Russians to elect Donald Trump.
Well, moving away from Manafort, though, there have been I've heard David K. Johnston, who knows Trump quite well, wrote a biography of him and is writing another one, has talked about Donald J. Trump doing business with Russian oligarchs, and there have been suggestions that Donald Trump has gotten loans from Deutsche Bank that were guaranteed by Russian interests. And given that Russia is a kleptocracy, that this could lead to being beholden to Vladimir Putin. I wonder if you could address that.
Well, I don't know about he said to have loans, direct loans from oligarchs or a Russian bank.
Well, Deutsche Bank. Through Russian influence in Deutsche Bank. And
Deutsche Bank, as you know, is a German bank. Trump has lots of loans which he has not paid to many, many people. I mean, if Deutsche Bank is foolish enough to loan Donald Trump money, that's their problem. I think that I'm from New York. I grew up not far from where Donald Trump grew up, and I worked on Wall Street for 10 years. I can tell you with certainty that the reason he's going to Deutsche Bank is because no one in New York will lend to him. So he's a horrible investment. He's gone bankrupt, what, two or three times. But all of this is known. So in order for – let's say that it's true. Let's say that the worst-case scenario is true, that Trump is in debt to Russian – directly in debt to Russian oligarchs. In order for that to matter, right, in order for them to have any power over him, he would have to be concerned about his reputation. I think we've seen that Donald Trump's maybe the most shameless person ever to grace the national stage. He certainly is not worried about his financial reputation, because he has continually lied about it for, you know, 40, 50 years now. So I simply don't buy the fact that would have any sort of, you know, blackmailing power over him. And besides, there's no evidence at all that Trump actually is in debt to Russian oligarchs.
So let's talk about the relationship between the U.S. and Russia. Well, first, I'd like to ask first, how do you see the Russian regime? I think there, you know, and I'm asking that because I know that my sense of it is that it is a kleptocracy, that it's run by oligarchs. I mean, certainly not a communist regime. They gave that up a long time ago. But what happened instead was that the old communist, you know, nomenclatura became incredibly rich, and, you know, that there is a fair amount of kleptocracy in it.
I don't dispute that at all. I think that Putin has, and I've said and written this elsewhere, that I'm quite convinced by the evidence that Putin has basically raided the treasury, and he's made his group of friends from St. Petersburg very wealthy men. I'm not sure, though, where I part company with people on this, that I'm not exactly sure why that would matter to U.S. foreign policy. We deal with regimes that are far more sinister and odious than the Russian regime. And the Russian people are quite happy with Putin's leadership, despite what you hear in the mainstream media in the United States. So I'm not really sure, you know, he's a crook, sure. is it our business? You know, I don't think so.
Okay. So then back to the U.S. relationship, you have written elsewhere that we cannot simply address the problem of Russia in 2017 in isolation from the wider expansionist and hegemonic trends of U.S. foreign policy of the last quarter century. That is a pretty strong and very interesting statement. I wonder if you could explain it.
Oh, sure. I'd be happy to. I think that a good place to start when looking at the wider trends of U.S. foreign policy over the past 25 years would be to look at the NATO alliance and what has been happening there since the end of the Cold War. At the end of the Cold War, the Soviet Union collapsed, and with it went the Warsaw Pact, which was the Soviet counter-alliance in Europe to NATO. That disappeared, but NATO not only remained, but it grew. And in successive waves, it gobbled up Central and Eastern European countries. Now it is on the border with the Russian Federation. And the Russians, I think, quite understandably, feel surrounded. We repeatedly call NATO the greatest military alliance, the strongest military alliance in the history of the world. Well, that's okay. But how do you think that, you know, the Russians are going to react to this, you know, extremely strong military alliance creeping up to its borders? The fateful moment, I believe, which explains, I think, a lot of Russia's foreign policy, happened at the NATO summit at Bucharest in 2008, when NATO said that Georgia and Ukraine will become members of NATO. And I think that that was an enormously reckless thing to do. And I think it explains Russia's defensiveness over the past 10 years or so.
And just curiously, you served under Hillary Clinton in the State Department. I mean, she seems to have evolved into quite a strong hawk on Russia. Was that true then, and why do you think it's true now?
Well, she was always a super hawk. And I think that the policies that she's championed have been, you know, extraordinarily reckless and damaging. And I did not, while I was very disturbed by the election result, I wasn't the only silver lining I could find. So at least Hillary wouldn't be president. I think that she's certainly more hawkish than even Trump, though we'll see about that. So no, Hillary has earned the enmity of the Kremlin. And I'll give you something I uncovered a few months ago. The State Department was ordered by a federal court to release a lot of Clinton emails because she had that, you know, private email or whatever. And so anyone can dig through these emails on the State Department website. And I was doing some digging, and I found an email from Hillary to one of her top aides. And one of the aides was transitioning. She was a Foreign Service officer. She was transitioning out of working on Hillary's direct staff, and she was going over to the NSC. And so it was basically a, you know, great working with you, good luck type of thing. But what Clinton wrote in the email was really revealing, because the aide was going to run, she was going over to the NSC to run Russia policy. And Clinton wrote, "It's really great that you're headed to the White House to plan our post-Putin Russia strategy." Well, that was written in February of 2012. You know, our post-Putin Russia strategy. You know, you can imagine the reaction of the Russians if and when they got a hold of that email. And no doubt that they did, because Clinton was sending it on her private server. I mean, you know, that's an extraordinary admission that, you know, the United States was actually looking to somehow subvert Putin's return to the Kremlin. We have to keep in mind that that was written a month before the Russian presidential election in March 2012. So talk about election interference, right? So it gives you a sort of snapshot of the mindset of the Clinton State Department. They were quite anxious about Putin's return, and apparently, or at least according to this email, they were already plotting a post-Putin Russia strategy.
So now, finally, to I think the concern that underlies all of this posturing over Russia, and even, you know, what might be going on, as we know, we're not so sure that Trump is going to be any less hawkish than Hillary. And that is the danger of this confrontation with Russia. I mean, the Democrats are not in power right now. Hillary is not in power. Do you think that there is a growing danger of nuclear war?
Well, yeah. And it's not just me who thinks of this. It's the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists, who last month moved up the hand of the famous doomsday clock 30 seconds. So it's two and a half minutes to midnight, according to the atomic scientists. The reason for that is pretty straightforward. The U.S., NATO, and Russia are on a collision course in a number of arenas. First of all, they are facing each other down in the Baltic region. There, of course, remains the war in Ukraine, where Russian troops are in the east, and NATO and American troops are in the west, in part of Ukraine. And then, of course, there's Syria. So in any one of these three theaters, there could be a catastrophic accident or something worse, which could set off a chain of events. The worrying thing is that political scientists don't really know all that much about the dynamics of escalation. So, you know, the idea that our military forces are circling each other in these three areas should worry everyone very much.
And Donald Trump is no John F. Kennedy.
Well, no, I'm afraid not. And John F. Kennedy is skilled, a politician, and as well educated a person as he was, didn't find his footing right away. Let's put it that way. And so, no, I think that, you know, the idea that we have someone so deeply and proudly ignorant of the world as President of the United States should worry us all.
What should we do? What should be our relationship to Russia?
Our relationship with Russia should be a normal one. It should be pragmatic and transactional. We have not a lot culturally in common with them. Our political systems are different, but that does not mean that we don't have shared global interests, and we should be focusing on our commonalities. We have shared interests in nuclear non-proliferation. We have shared interests in fighting Salafist terrorism. We have shared interests in peace on the European continent. Down the road, we're going to have shared interests in managing a growing and perhaps revanchist China. So while pundits in this country and a lot of our political class focus on the fact that Putin's corrupt, that the elections aren't exactly free and fair over there, that they pass on occasion legislation that we may not approve of, like their kind of a barbaric approach to LGBT and women's issues. All of that is true. I don't dispute that they have significant problems of their own, as we do, by the way. But we have very important shared interests, and we should look at them as a potential partner, not as an adversary. Because the fact of the matter is that, as a friend and mentor of mine never tires of saying, American security runs through Moscow, whether we like it or not. So the American political elite needs to grow up and get over whatever qualms they have about whether or not Mr. Putin is a crook or a bad guy, and get on with the hard work of diplomacy and the hard work of working with the Russians in order to defeat ISIS in the Middle East.
Well, James W. Carden, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thanks very much for having me.
James W. Carden was an advisor on Russia at the U.S. State Department under Hillary Clinton between 2011 and 2013, and now works with the American Committee for East-West Accord. His recent article for The Nation is, "The House Intelligence Committee Hearing on Russia Was Political Theater." You've been listening to What You Need to Know, a special web-only series for Writer's Voice. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.